The judicial branch of our government functions in a profoundly different way from the other two. You could say, the less it has to do, the better off we are. Alaska's Supreme Court Chief Justice is all about reducing the load. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, Chief Justice Dana Faber returns to the program to talk with you. As always, pending case off limits. Phones are open statewide, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. We continue a discussion we started last week about fair and equal application of justice on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the newly restored historic Anchorage Hotel. You can find out more about this boutique hotel in the heart of downtown at historicanchoragehotel.com. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, the first time we tried this, it was really quite an experiment, and we weren't sure it was going to work out. But the person who approached us and said, I wouldn't mind being on the radio and answering questions from callers was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Dana Fabe. And it was a successful program, I think. And she termed out as Chief Justice, and she returned as Chief Justice. And I think that for the third time she's returned as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and she was ready to come back. And so I'm very happy to welcome you back to the microphones, the statewide microphones of Talk of Alaska.
And thank you for having me, Steve.
Well, it's great that you come forward like this, because it's difficult because of pending cases that you can't talk about.
Right.
But you're pretty good at being able to figure out how to, you can always just say, no, I'm not going to talk about that.
After 25 years on the bench, I've had some practice.
So, as a judge, do you have trouble staying awake sometimes?
Never. It's the most engaging, exciting, rewarding job, and I never have trouble staying awake. When we do the oral arguments, we're all really prepared for those arguments, and it's a conversation with the lawyers and an ability to have our questions answered, and it's an incredibly exciting, engaging process.
Now, we all, probably many of us, are familiar with the books that have been written about the U.S. Supreme Court, inside the Supreme Court, so-and-so law clerk, this and that. Do you have a comparable staff of clerks working for you in the Supreme Court so that each justice has an actual staff that is researching, going down to the law library and all that?
Right. Each judge and justice in our court system has a law clerk, at least one law clerk. And in the Alaska Supreme Court, we each have three law clerks who work with us, but we all rely on their work. The law clerks prepare a bench memoranda to help prepare us, and one chambers will assign a law clerk to do the bench memo that all five of us rely on so that we can use their time efficiently. So, we have our law clerks doing research.
You reminded me this morning that the Supreme Court still meets in the old court building. You had a brand new court building. Why didn't you guys take the top floor?
Well, the brand new court building was designed to be a trial court building and was designed to consolidate all of the trial judges in one building. As it turns out, the district court judges are coming back to the Boney building where the Alaska Supreme Court has always been. I came up here as a law clerk to the Alaska Supreme Court, and my current office is right down the hall from the very first office I had as a law clerk in 1976.
And things usually don't work that way. You have been on the Supreme Court for how long now?
Almost 18 years.
Wow. And how often does the court actually hear arguments?
We hear arguments every month, 10 months a year, for about a week, depending on how many cases are ready for argument. And then we also meet together as a court at least twice a month to handle cases that have been submitted without oral argument or to deal with rule changes or administrative policy issues.
So there's a workload right there, but I've noticed that you have put your attention into a number of administrative matters. And you know, that's one of the reasons that I was excited to have you here, is because you are really all about trying to keep stuff from getting to the level of a judge and the court system having to use their time on cases that maybe didn't need to go that far. You can start, let's say, with mediation.
Exactly. And not only is that something that means that the case file doesn't stay on the shelf of the judge of the clerk's office, but it also means that people have an opportunity to resolve their own cases. And clearly, when they have input and control in how their case comes out, they're going to be happier with the result, even if it's not their ideal that they started out thinking they wanted the case to resolve with.
So, and this could be like any kind of case, but I noticed the numbers are really startling on the domestic type of issues.
Exactly. That caseload is growing. And for example, we have the Early Resolution Project, where we look for cases that have just been filed where the parties don't have lawyers. And then volunteer lawyers coordinated by Alaska Legal Services and volunteer mediators come and meet with those parties, and a judge sits and takes care of the case, usually just a few weeks after it's been filed, and it's one-stop shopping. They put the resolution or settlement on the record, the judge takes the required testimony, and a judgment is produced, and the person walks away, or the parties walk away with their case resolved right on the spot.
So it's, sometimes people use the justice system, I think, there's personal businesses going on there, things that they don't want to face or don't want to talk to, or the animus they have towards another person and everything. And when that gets into the courtroom, I would think that can be time-consuming.
Well, more than that, I think people feel better about the result because they know their families best. They know what their own personal situation is best. It's a time that's very difficult for families to go through. It's probably the hardest thing they've ever gone through. And if a judge, not knowing their family as well as they do, makes a decision on the information presented in the court, it may be a solution that the parties aren't, neither party is happy with. So if the parties can get together and resolve their case, having that control over the situation and the resolution, it's really the best for the family.
So I was going over your State of the Judiciary speech, and you said this early resolution program, which is primarily what we're talking about, that all these divorce and custody cases came before, you know, had the option of going to early resolution. You took 420 of them and got almost 80% resolved.
We're now over 600, and again, the 80% settlement rate is there. I handled these cases myself back in July. I'm set to do it again in December as an early resolution judge. And in one afternoon, we disposed of seven cases and resolved them completely with people coming away with their judgments.
So how does that work? How does a Chief Justice get to do that?
Well, I was very excited about the program and wanted to see better how it works. So I
volunteered. So you're allowed to go down in the regular courtroom and
it was great. Yeah.
Who's going to tell you no, right?
I guess that's right.
that is beautiful. So what does that in the larger scope of things and the huge caseload and so forth, is this a substantial reduction? It would seem like it would be.
Well, we have thousands of those cases, of the domestic relations cases. So even 600 resolving early is a reduction in the number of cases that continue to be disputed. But the best thing, again, for the families in these cases is that they're resolved just within weeks of that initial divorce complaint and answer being filed. And so it does mean that the family has certainty moving forward. They're able to have that resolution. And it does mean that the case doesn't go in and out of the courtroom dozens of times as the case is being processed.
So I want to go back to your state of the judiciary, which I assume you're about to get another one ready for next January.
Yes, February usually. Yes.
But it was interesting because, of course, you have to speak for the whole system, essentially, you know, the courts and the prosecutors and public defenders and everybody.
Right.
And so you know, you're covering a lot of ground and not too much time. And I noticed that you specifically said that there had been a whole sequence of various types of commissions and bodies that had looked at state and tribal, and they'd all kind of said the same thing, that what we have isn't working with relation to the administration of justice in rural areas. There needed to be better ways to work with the tribal courts. And of course, we just had another one come out, and that was the subject of our show last week. It was very interesting to have the Attorney General on, saying, "Look, you know, we know we're trying. We're going to have something. It's being vetted now by the tribes. So it's probably a good thing before it comes out in the public. But we're moving towards all this. It's probably encouraging for you to hear."
Yes, very much.
And maybe you could just speak to this: is how does the I mean, there comes a point where you come up against the Constitution. I don't think you have a case right now that deliberately says that. You may be ICWA put aside, the Child Welfare Act put aside, because I know you have pending cases on that. But just generally speaking, you know, the Constitution and tribes is...
Right. Well, we do have a current case pending on the jurisdictional issues regarding tribal courts and judgments in tribal court cases. But what I can say is the court system has been very interested in working with and collaborating with tribal court judges to incorporate some of the restorative justice principles involved in circle sentencing into state court proceedings, consistent, of course, with state law on sentencing, and also working with tribal judges in joint training efforts. I went and visited the Sitka tribe when we were down at Mount Edgecombe doing Supreme Court Live last fall, and met with Chief Judge David Volek and Judge Peter Esquiro to talk about the possibility of a joint training with tribal court judges and what would they be interested in learning about. And they chose self-represented litigants and some of the techniques in the courtroom in handling self-represented cases. And we met with many tribal judges and all the state court judges in October sat down with an expert in the field and shared our own experiences and learned from each other.
So what I'm hearing there is that, you know, pending cases obviously can't talk about, but if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't ever get into the state judicial system, there's no real conflict. You know, whether it's a criminal matter or whatever, if it's resolved at a certain point, it just simply doesn't reach the level of any kind of constitutional conflict. And the same goes with working with people in tribal courts and training context and on like that.
Right. Our alternative dispute rule has for a long time allowed for the parties to go to a tribal court or elder council to resolve their case in some alternative way. We are just considering this week, and I think it will be signed next week, a new court rule that will provide some guidelines and guidance to judges who are interested in the circle sentencing and restorative justice procedures in sentencing cases, and that can involve the entire community, the victim and the community. Of course, everybody would have to agree, the victim and the parties would have to agree to the case being handled with a circle sentencing, but it allows the victims and the community to come and talk to the defendant about what the defendant's conduct has done to the community and to make recommendations to the judge as to how the case should be sentenced.
That's always a interesting part of any conviction when you get to sentencing, and you know, often it seems difficult for the judge because they really have to exercise judgment here right. and decide what is going to be best. I mean, there's recommendations and there's guidelines and so forth, but they still have to decide what's going to be best for the society at large, for the deterrent effect, or all these different factors that have to be brought in. I would imagine that one never gets old. That one is always going to be tough.
It's one of the most difficult things a judge does.
The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. And email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And I see some questions already coming in on that line there. For the Honorable Dana Fabe, the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court, our guest today statewide on Talk of Alaska. I guess you handled the tribal thing so adroitly. I'm going to try another hot potato and see what happens here. And this is something that almost always reaches the Supreme Court, and that is the power of initiative, which is spelled out in the Constitution. And, you know, I've read a number of Supreme Court rulings on it, and they tend to say the same thing. They tend to put—I don't want to get real specific, but they tend to put the presumption on the public to say, look, you know, we'll try and weigh in the favor of the public's right to write laws when we can. If everything else is equal, that's how we're going to rule.
And often there are constitutional challenges to the initiative itself, the law that's going to be enacted by initiative. And again, generally, we defer that until after the initiative has come before the voters and don't determine the constitutionality of the question until afterwards, unless there's controlling authority that would make it clear that it was unconstitutional.
Okay, well, let's say that the Attorney General says, oh, this is clearly whatever, power of appropriation, whatever it is, and there's a whole line of court rulings that show you can't do that by initiative. And then somebody goes to court and tries to get the Attorney General overruled.
And that's how the case would come before us, and then we would need to look at the facts of that case and the law in that case and make the best determination we can. Again, the general rule is we don't rule on the constitutionality unless it's clear and there's controlling authority that either the law itself would be unconstitutional if passed, or we do determine whether or not something is appropriate for the initiative process or whether or not the Constitution and enabling statutes.
Yeah, so sometimes you will. Sometimes you will
right.
do that. 1-800-478-8255, the telephone number, and this one is from Teeny. It says, could you speak about the court's outreach work with youth? What does the program involve, et cetera? What a softball.
Well, yeah. It's
and, of course, you were just up in Barrow, which yeah. I think she might be from.
Well, it's an issue that I'm very passionate about. We have several different programs. Supreme Court Live is one where we have handled real Supreme Court arguments right on the stage of a high school. Former Chief Justice Walter Carpinetti is the one who thought of this program. And while he was Chief Justice, we did it in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage. When I became Chief, I wanted to expand it to other parts of the state. So we've done it now at Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka, as well as Barrow High just this past October. And what we do is we teach the case to the students. The attorneys in the community take materials out to the teachers in the classrooms and teach the case so that the students have read excerpts from the briefs and know everything about the case so that when they come into the auditorium and hear the arguments presented and they are the real, it's not a play, it's the real arguments and the real case. It's the only time we're going to have oral argument in that case. We sit as a court on a bench right on the high school stage. The arguments are made. And then when we go back to deliberate behind the curtain I think we were in the band room in Barrow High, that the attorneys are out on the stage answering questions that the kids may have, and then the court returns to the stage in our street clothes, out of our robes, and we answer questions. that the students may have. We also have the Color of Justice, which is a program that we've done both in Anchorage for over 10 years and in Sitka, at Mount Edgecombe, to bring law professors up from outside and lawyers and judges together with teenagers to tell them about how exciting a legal career might be, with a real focus in particular on minority students, although all students are eligible to participate. We have worked with iCivics, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's program for junior high students, which is an online program it's hard to call them games, but they really are wonderful, fun exercises where students become lawyers arguing famous Supreme Court cases, or they're members of law firms. And I remember talking to Justice O'Connor about this program when she was just in the design phase, and she was very excited about one of the games where, if as a law firm you earned points, then you could select new furniture for your law office as one of the prizes for the game. And for real lawyers, that probably is something that they like to do, too.
I think it was Colonel Mustard with a lead pipe in the conservatory.
Exactly.
1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. I have to say, just brag a little bit, because you brought up about legal careers. And just the day after the show last week with Troy Ide about tribal justice, I had a call, and it was a young man, and he said, I just have to tell you this. I was considering a legal career. I was considering going to law school and decided against it. And I listened to that show and I've changed my mind. I want to represent my tribe.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It just like blew my mind, you know, one of the all-time great phone call feedbacks.
Absolutely.
You get. So we're talking with the Honorable Dana Fabe, Chief Justice, Alaska Supreme Court. She's live and ready to take your questions. And if it's off limits, you'll just say so at 1-800-478-8255. Charlie joins the program from Homer. Charlie, you're on the air with Justice Fabe.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Chief Justice. Well, I've got kind of a philosophical question, I guess. How do you get the government to obey the law and the Constitution? And I've been charged with a state statute that had no application whatsoever for a public statement that I made, freedom of speech, for, you know, First Amendment. And the state wouldn't play by the rules. They charged me, they put me in jail, and they let me out, and this one has the charges to get me to shut up, I guess, so that I don't talk in public. You perhaps saw the headline a few years ago, Homer Gadfly arrested. But I've had a similar situation in another state where the state itself will not abide by their own rules. So you file a brief that conforms to the rules of the court, and the court denies it or doesn't hear it. And what do you do? And what do we do? So it's kind of a philosophical question: is how can we? Since we don't, I guess, have an enforcement clause in the Constitution, how do we get the state, the government, the prosecution, and the courts to follow the rules and the law?
Well, that's a fantastic question, Charlie. And it's true, the court doesn't have an army.
Right, but I think the public has trust and confidence in the court because the court is fair and impartial as an arbiter of that kind of dispute. And so when, I won't speak about that particular case because we never know what's going to be coming before us, but the role of the courts is to protect the rights of the individual under the Constitution and under the laws. And so I think your question is really a complex one and a sophisticated one. It has several components, and one is one really touches on the very reason that we have courts. A second is the reason we need fair and impartial courts, and courts where the judges are approaching every case in a neutral gear, looking at the facts and law of that case without having to, they're having, as with elected judges, having had their campaigns funded by special interests, so that they are starting out looking at what the law requires. And then you touched on another point that's very important, and that is what happens if you're filing a brief and you may not be familiar with court processes, and what happens if the court doesn't accept the brief. And I think that's a very, very important topic. You know, the Alaska court system's website has a self-represented litigants link that goes to so many resources. If it's the appellate arena, tells you how to file an appeal and what forms you need and what some of the procedural rules and requirements are. But we take very seriously the need for the court to provide access to the courts for those who don't have representation, and there are increasing numbers of people who don't.
Charlie.
Yes, well, I appreciate that. The answer, I went to, in my particular case, I went to consulted with several attorneys at law and was told that I didn't have a case. The government has, what's the word, they're not required.
Immunity?
Immunity, that they have blanket immunity, and they can, there's no way to win a case. You're just wasting your time to do it. I was advised by three different attorneys at law in the state of Alaska to drop it, and which is what I did. It's just a, if we're going to have a constitutional republic at the national level and a democracy at the state level, we have to have a court system that settles our disputes, so we don't have to settle them ourselves, which gets in the past kind of bloody, and we don't want to go that route again. So I do appreciate your answers and your help, and appreciate the program, Steve. You guys have a great day.
And it was a great question.
Yeah, Charlie, thanks. It's a work in progress. I think we all agree on that. Let's go to Carol. Joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Carol, with Justice Fabe. Yes.
And I feel honored to have this opportunity. I have a question for the judge, and that is, a few years back, I was given a car, and I had 6 blocks to drive it to get to my place to find out how to get insurance and registration. I was pulled over because the officer said the tags were expired, and the car was impounded, and I was given a fee in community service, even though I explained to the officer. Now, since then, I've never had a record before nor after, and I'm a licensed teacher. It says on my record now, DWI, which a lot of times is taken as driving without insurance. Or not driving without insurance, but driving while intoxicated. Mm. And it has really been hard. It's been very challenging. And I called a couple lawyers to find out if the record could be expunged, and they said no, not at all in the state of Alaska. Is that true?
Well, generally, the record, it sounds like this may be an issue of even just the labeling of the record and using initials that an acronym that may be misleading. And I hadn't been aware of this issue that driving without insurance is being called DWI on our court view system. So it's something I can find out about from our administrative director. But generally, once the court record is there, it is in the system. So it sounds like it's a mislabeling issue, really, that you're addressing. And I'm afraid I don't know the answer to it.
Well, it's misunderstanding between those that see it,
right?
Because driving under the influence is DUI.
Exactly.
But they just assume driving DWI, which is driving without insurance, is driving while intoxicated. And
right.
I can't get it taken care of. Nobody wants to touch it.
I can hear your frustration, Carol.
Right. And I would say, I would suggest contacting the administrative director's office about this issue, because the administrative director of the court system deals with all of the court view and court records, and she may be able to direct you to the right person. But you're right that we used to call driving under the influence, driving while intoxicated. So DWI does have a certain connotation. You raise an interesting point. It's one that I wasn't aware of in the past.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right, Carol. Thanks for your having the courage to call. This one comes from O'Connor says, thank you for your participation in mock trial. Does Justice Fave have any comments about her experiences with mock trial? My son argued a mock trial case before Judge Fave in 2010, and it was a terrific experience which left a lasting and encouraging impression with him. Another softball.
Well, it's a fantastic program, another program that we do for outreach with students. You know, the mock trial competition is a national competition, and Alaska has had incredibly strong teams, and they're high school students who play the attorneys and witnesses of both sides of a particular case. There's a new case every year with interesting and fun facts, and then they have a round, different rounds in the competition for an entire weekend, and on Saturday afternoon, the final round is argued up in the Alaska Supreme Court courtroom, and I have had the privilege on a number of occasions of being one of the three judges to judge that final round, and I am so impressed by the students and the coaches they work with who put in hundreds of hours to have these students so prepared, and we have sent teams outside to the national competition, and there have been teams from Chugiak and West and from high schools in Kenai and Palmer, and they've been amazing.
What is it about Alaska? We got a great debate team over at UAA, too.
Exactly.
We're just good at arguing, I think. 1-800-478-8255 as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Historic Anchorage Hotel, offering space for rehearsal dinners, engagement parties, business meetings, or social gatherings. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com.
Over 6,000 Alaskans are living with Alzheimer's or related dementia. November is National Family Caregivers Month and Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you're caring for an elderly, chronically ill, or disabled family member, there are resources to help you and your loved ones. For information, visit Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska at alzalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Aging and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
I'm looking over at the phone lights, and they are lighting up. Our phone screener reports heavy telephone traffic, people wanting to speak with Chief Justice Dana Fave. So I'll just throw this very short one out and then get on to more calls. And that is, you spoke of representing yourself in front of the court or representing yourself in family cases and things like that, representing yourself before a tribal proceeding of some sort. Can you give me maybe two or three things that people ought to know and don't about representing themselves?
Well, actually, I think the best thing I can say is that our court website has so many resources. It would be difficult for me to give the tutorial that website gives. You know, we were one of the first states in the country to have a family law self-help center that really serves as a concierge service for people who are not represented, who need to know everything they need to know.
Sure, one of the first, huh?
We were one of the first, and not only that, but the woman who designed our system, which was used as a model around the rest of the country, Catherine Altenator, has just been, and she worked for the court, has just been appointed the national director of the Self-Represented Litigant Network in Washington, D.C. She will be the top person in the country, and it's because of her work in Alaska and the recognition she received from her work here.
I would still like to get maybe a panel of judges come in here and say, here's the most aggravating things that they do.
Well, you know, really, we don't feel that way. And it's our duty to make sure that they understand the procedures that they need to follow in order to provide better access to the court system to self-represented litigants. Again, we have increasing numbers of them, and the website gives them every form they need, but they can also call the self-help center to find out answers to questions about what would I need to bring to court, or again, it's not legal advice, but it's procedural advice on what they need to bring to court in order to be prepared and get the judge what the judge needs.
I hope the legislature wasn't listening. They'll be able to cut the budget for that.
Well, you know, the court is a very good steward of public funds, and we do a lot with a small fraction of the state's budget. And for example, we've started with no additional money, having evening hours for certain cases, and after late afternoon, early evening hours, and Saturday hours. Our thought was, you can now get a pediatrician appointment on a Saturday when you're not working. Why shouldn't you be able to come take care of a traffic case or a dissolution or divorce matter that's uncontested?
Well, because the judge wants to get home and have dinner. That's why.
Well, we've taken our magistrate judges and flexed their schedules, and without an additional penny from the legislature, extended our hours in Palmer, Fairbanks, and Anchorage to provide better service to the public.
Wow. Chief Justice Dana Fabe is the guest, and Willie joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Willie.
Thank you very much, and I sure enjoy having this opportunity to ask. Now, the question I have out here, we're in remote southwest Alaska. The area that our Superior Court district covers is huge.
Right.
But what the state has done out here is they've taken a string and a pencil and drawn a 35 air mile circumference around from the city of Bethel, and then basically I call it putting a rat cage in there, and you're trapped for jury duty. And I don't understand. We literally, they've changed the rules out here to where we only have to do 1 month at a time, but in essence, what you do is you do 1 month every year. You're getting a call if you live in that 35-mile radius. Now you're having to fly people like from Tulik-Sack or Athmuthluk, Kasigluk, those types of places. They get it too, you know. But I want to know, how come we're having to deal with when over half the cases come from way outside of this 35-mile rat cage? How come the rest of the communities, Hooper Bay, Shevac, Platinum, Good News, Eek, Tuntutuliak, Kipnuk, how come none of those people ever have to come and serve as peers for their, you know, for their own people? It seems pretty unfair, and a lot of people are really unhappy. I mean, it's like you're guaranteed a trip down there, whether you like it or not, every year, and you can just about count on 1 to 2 months, you'll get the same recall every time. Now, why can't the state, with all its money and its resources, afford to bring these people in from off the coast and all the points of distance, more than 35 miles from Bethel, instead of cornering us that live right here? I realize we're 6,000 people in Bethel, but that's no excuse to make us the main jurors for everybody else's problem out here on this delta. And that's kind of the question I had. Just why won't the state spring the money and bring them in?
Well, I think this is a really great question. I'm really glad you asked it, because it's an issue that we're actually looking at right now. I've set up a jury working group. I'm co-chairing it personally with presiding judge Mike McDonald, who is the presiding judge of the 4th Judicial District. And of course, Bethel is in the 4th. And one of the primary issues we're looking at is burnout of Bethel jurors, because we recognize that those jurors who are serving in Bethel and who are being called in are being called in too much, and they're being burned out. I am very concerned about this, too. I think there are a number of moving parts to this question, and it's not the only question that this working group is looking at, but it's an important one. And some of the moving parts are not only the travel costs that you discussed, and I think the court system pays over $1 million a year in jury travel costs to bring jurors in, but the burnout, using jury time more efficiently, calling in panels that are closer to the number we really need, and we're looking at statistics on how many jurors are called in who never get called for the trial but are having to spend time, and whether or not that it's called jury utilization, whether or not we're targeting the right number of jurors on a particular panel. We're looking at those issues along with issues of how to use technology to make the jury experience better. I think I mentioned that a moment ago, as well as using the jurors' time more efficiently once they are called in a case. But Bethel jurors and the burnout and the fact, of course, Bethel has a very high trial rate. When we were out with the Judicial Council for the selection committee meeting for the new district court judge in Bethel, the clerk of court mentioned to us that about 30% of the state's misdemeanor trials are in the Bethel court. So that that's another piece that that factors into it, is that it's a very high trial rate, meaning lots of jurors are needed. But you raise a great point, and it is something that is one of my focus areas right now, and we just had our first meeting of this new working group that I put together last month.
Is there a way that Willie could, if he has suggestions, get through to the working group with him?
Yes, in fact, what I would say is if you trying to think of how to get the right email address to him. It's a long, clunky email address.
Wouldn't you know it?
But if he, Mara Rabinowitz is our court communications counsel, and it's mrabinowitz at appellate.courts.state.ak.us.
Oh, boy.
But I let me give some thought as we're chatting,
okay.
And if I can think of a more direct way to get that information to our caller, I'll try. But
I love to watch the wheels of justice turn. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I was wondering, couldn't you just go online to State of Alaska, pull up Alaska Supreme Court, and be able to find this lady right there?
There should be some way of getting through that way. We're going to think about it, Willie, and take it up later on in the show before it's over. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Wow. That I feel his pain. I bet you a lot of people feel
that
pain.
Yes.
And that's probably big news in Bethel that you're trying to do something about it. So thank you very much for that. Christopher joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Chief Justice Dana Fabe.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for your service, Chief Justice. And so I have a question that's more philosophical. I'm guessing you do have a case along these lines somewhere in the caseload, but I'm not asking a technical question, more, again, philosophical. So in the Constitution, Article 1 is basically equal rights and responsibility. I think it's called the Inherent Rights Clause. And as an LGBT citizen in 1998, I witnessed my rights being stripped, in my opinion, according to what I believe is a fair reading of the Constitution. And, of course, this issue has been very big on the national horizon, and it's very likely coming back to Alaska sometime, if not already. So here's my question. What is the meaning of the term inherent in the phrase inherent rights under the Constitution in a legal constitutional sense?
Well, it's a very good question, but it's unfortunately the kind of question, even as an abstract conceptual question, I can't answer, because if a case comes before us, that's the very type of interpretation issue that would be presented to us. So if I were to comment on it, I would be commenting on, we're prohibited not only from commenting on pending cases, but impending cases, meaning cases that could come before us. And so I understand the question. It's an important and interesting question, but I'm afraid I can't give you much more specific answer than that, other than to say the court, of course, is we decide the cases that are brought to us. We don't decide what cases we want to decide on the Alaska Supreme Court. Every court case, we don't have an intermediate court for civil cases, at least. So every civil case that's handled at the trial court level, if somebody wants to appeal, they come directly to the Alaska Supreme Court.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, Christopher, I can see it's kind of like asking, what does Aboriginal title exactly mean? When you can't really ask a judge to say that because they're going to have to rule on it. Yeah. Thanks for the question, though, Christopher. It was worth putting forward. This one comes from Christine, who grew up in Kodiak and wants to know if you see the Alaska court system getting involved with immigration issues or whether that remains federal.
That's pretty much federal, although it touches on a very important and interesting issue, and that is the need to provide interpreter services for many of the customers who come into the Alaska court system. And we are seeing many, many people with limited English proficiency who have state court cases where we need to be providing interpreter services. And we just recently adopted a court rule that clarifies that that it is the court's duty to get those interpreters made available to litigants and witnesses of limited English proficiency. And we have a number of initiatives that we have worked on and, again, provided some leadership for the rest of the country. We have a consortium of the university and the hospitals and the court, where we have a language interpreter center where we share interpreters who are trained interpreters and available. We have a language line when there's not an interpreter of a particular language available through the center, and we can get a telephonic interpreter. We actually are even helping to assist people who come to the front counter of our court systems by using the wonderful resources we have in our incredible court staff. Our court clerical staff are amazing, those who work in the court clerk's office, and many of them have a second language. And so what we're doing is giving them just a brief two-day training, and that way if somebody comes up to the court counter and speaks Tagalog and needs an interpreter, we will call on somebody who works for the court system, perhaps in another office, to come in and help at the court front desk. So I think that's where when we were dealing with people of limited English proficiency. But in terms of actual immigration cases, those are mostly in federal court.
You know, it's interesting. Banks nowadays, often the tellers will have, a little sub thing on their name tag says, I speak Tagalog or I speak Russian or whatever, Spanish. And use the resources you got, for Pete's sake.
And, we recently put a poster in every courthouse. I talked about this in my State of the Judiciary address last February. But when you go to a hospital, often by the elevator, you will see a poster that's called the Patient's Bill of Rights and talks about the fact that you have the right to be treated with respect and to know what's in your file and et cetera. And I thought that really that was something that we could provide for people who come into the courthouse. And we did a poster of basically a pledge by the court of procedural fairness that when you come to the court, whether you're a witness or a juror or a litigant or a party in a case, that you will that the court will listen to you, whether it's court staff or the judge will listen to you, will treat you with respect, and will answer your questions about court procedure. And when we developed that poster, we decided that it really, in order to provide greater access to this message, we translated it into the six languages that are most often requested for interpreters and translation in our courthouses, including Hmong, Vietnamese, Korean, Russian, Tagalog, and Yupik, and Spanish. So the poster now has all of those translations on the poster.
Well, Chief Justice Dana Faber is our guest, and still open for calls. There are quite a few stacked up. You might want to try the email at talkatalaskapublic.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Chief Justice Dana Fabe, we earlier had a call from someone who had a DWI, and people kept thinking it was a DUI, and she wanted expunged from her record. And you said, well, we can't really do that. And now we have an email, a similar thing, where a person was mistakenly arrested for something, and yet it still shows up as an arrest. And she says, we need to keep working on that. We need to do something about that. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. David joins the program from Anchorage. David, you're on the air with Justice Fabe.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the program. Thanks, Justice Fabe. Over the last fall, there was a couple of NPR stories on from down in the States about judges, kind of profiles of judges that were running for election. And I was listening to those, and I thought, I know that judges don't run for election here, but how are they picked, and I mean, how are they kept on the bench? I'm not really sure how all that works.
Well, it's a great question. You know, one of the constitutional framers really had the ability to look at every other judicial selection system in the country, including elections and merit selection systems, when they framed our judicial article. And they picked the very best way of selecting judges because it makes sure that we have the best and the brightest on our bench, but it also gives accountability to the system, unlike, for example, the life appointment of the federal system. The voters are able to weigh in and determine whether a judge should continue to serve. So when there's a judicial opening, anybody who's qualified for that opening in terms of the minimum residence and minimum practice time applies. The Alaska Judicial Council, which is always chaired by the Chief Justice, but contains three public members appointed by the governor to six-year terms and three attorney members, review every application, do a lot of background information checking, everything from checking references to credit information, and looking at whether there have been disciplinary issues for that applicant. They interview every applicant, and they send a short list of at least two applicants to the governor, and then the governor selects the judge from that short list. At retention time, the Judicial Council does a full report card of every judge who is standing for retention, and each judge stands for every so many years, depending on their level of office. And the voters are able to get that information both through the Alaska Judicial Council website and a Know Your Judges Alaska website, where peace officers, social workers, jurors, attorneys, and others who have had experience before that judge are able to weigh in to let the voters know what kind of job has that judge done. And the Judicial Council hears from the public in public hearings, makes recommendations to the voters of which judges should be retained and which judges have had problems and shouldn't be retained, so that the voters can inform themselves before they vote. And the one thing I will say is, I think I've heard from a lot of people, some of them friends, saying, well, I don't know enough about the judges to vote on the ballot. It's a long ballot. I turn it over. There are all these judges. I don't know anything about them. And so I just don't fill that part of the ballot out. And I will say it's extremely important that voters educate themselves, because the key to a fair and impartial judiciary is to make sure that we have good judges on the bench and that they stay on the bench, and that those who may not be good judges are removed from the bench. And so that's something that's a very important thing for the voters to do.
But in reality, you know, the commission rarely recommends non-retention.
Actually, you would be surprised. I mean, it's rare in the sense that it isn't many judges each election cycle, and that's because our selection process is so excellent that the people who get selected as judges have been through such stringent screening, and only the very top of the field, the most qualified people, go to the governor. Usually they perform beautifully and are really quite excellent at their job, and they're diligent and they're conscientious and they prepare and they're smart and they're knowledgeable and they apply the law fairly. But we have, in the past few election cycles, I think maybe three in the last four election cycles, the Judicial Council has recommended against a judge who's had severe problems in performance. And in each case, the voters have been able to determine whether to retain that judge or not.
Well, you're being challenged here also by Jen, who says maybe it would be better to discourage people from representing themselves, considering that self-represented litigants require a lot of extra work by employees of the court system, and the cases are less successful than those in which the party is represented by a lawyer. Would it be beneficial to the party and the system to dissuade people from representing themselves? Is it irresponsible not to, especially in cases when often family law, one party has representation, the other doesn't? I'm glad you're providing support for this option, but it seems clear self-representation is seldom the ideal way to pursue a case. Beautifully argued.
Well, it's a beautifully presented question. I agree, and I agree with Jen that that there are tremendous challenges to those who are trying to represent themselves, and we try to smooth that path and make it a clearer path on what they need to do. But certainly, if somebody can afford a lawyer, I think it's great to have a lawyer. And in a family law case, in a child custody case, if someone is having a lawyer provided by Alaska Legal Services or the Network on Domestic Violence pro bono program, then they have a right to an appointed counsel, and they're represented themselves by the Office of Public Advocacy. But in most cases, if one party is represented and the other isn't, the one party who's represented may have private counsel, and then there's no right to counsel at this point to be appointed. And I think that presents a challenge. Again, one of the benefits of the Early Resolution Project is that we have only taken cases where people are self-represented, and then Alaska Legal Services has coordinated volunteer lawyers and volunteer mediators to come work with those litigants to be able to resolve their case and get that representation by counsel afforded to those who are in that program.
Are judges allowed to participate in these kind of proceedings?
They can't participate as attorneys, but they can. But again, many of the judges have volunteered, in addition to the rest of their caseloads, to be judges in the early resolution project.
They can be judge, but can they be a mediator? Can they actually sit down with the people and say, "Look, you are," and just try and get them to agree?
Actually, as a trial judge, and I was on the trial bench for 7.5 years, I did many, many settlement conferences in these cases. And sometimes when the parties would come into the courtroom and they were only disputing one or two minor items, which may not have really been minor to them at all, or they wouldn't have been disputing them, I would suggest, let's try a settlement conference. And if we don't, if we aren't able to settle the case and you don't want me as a judge, I'll get you a different judge to try it.
Thanks so much, Chief Justice Dana Fabe. And I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank of Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for more than 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.